With Thanksgiving just 2 days away, I want to take the time this week to reflect on what we can be thankful for this year, especially as it relates to legislation passed in 2024, shifts in political patterns after the election, and some characteristics of California overall. I'm your host, Tess Abraham, and join me for this Thanksgiving episode of the California Conversation. Welcome back to the show, and let me say, happy early Thanksgiving. I hope that you're excited to spend time with family or friends this Thursday, and that no matter your circumstances, you're able to find something that you can be thankful for this year. If you're struggling with that, then hopefully this episode will help you out a little bit. All joking aside, I know that sometimes talking about California politics can get heavy. On this show, we tend to focus on the downfalls, on responding to legislation that has negative effects on us, both economically and socially. Which makes sense because I hope to challenge all of us together not to look away from bad legislation or bad leadership, but to bring it to light for the goal of affecting change. But this week isn't a week to focus on the negative side. This is a week to focus on gratitude. To that end, I've compiled a few categories to break down for you today, including some good legislation passed this year, positive movement in our state during this last election, and overall characteristics of California that I think we can all be grateful for together. As a disclaimer, this episode will look a little like your Thanksgiving dinner table, with a mashup of several different components that hopefully all weave together in the end to help you as you celebrate Thanksgiving. That requires us to look at some heavy topics, because to fully appreciate good legislation, we have to discuss the problems that exist in the first place to make the legislation necessary. So stick with me, even when it seems like we've moved away from positivity. I also want to remind you that while today's episode isn't as research heavy as most weeks, I have still compiled all the resources used in today's episode in a corresponding article on my website, which I will link in the show notes. So go check it out if you want more information on any of the topics we discussed today. I want to start by looking at a few bills that were passed this year that I think are good bills, moving our state in a positive direction. After all, with 1,200 bills passed in this legislative year, there have to be some things that leave a positive mark. Right? Let's start with crime. Like we've discussed already on several episodes of this podcast, crime in California is a rising problem. We saw that one reason for this was the long-term effects of Prop 47, which was passed back in 2014. Just to reiterate, by lowering the classifications and penalties for certain crimes, it both limited law enforcement and incentivized crime, which has just led to a downward spiral in both theft and the drug epidemic. We saw in the election a few weeks ago that Prop 36, which reversed Prop 47, passed, which is incredible news. But believe it or not, there are also several other bills that were passed through the legislature this year related to stemming the tide of crime across the state. Assembly Bill 2943 was passed to address organized theft and crime in concert. If a person steals goods under a value of $950, then under Prop 47, it was charged as a misdemeanor. However, this has encouraged theft rings and organized crime, as individuals work together to terrorize local businesses and commit several thefts without real recourse. What AB 2943 acknowledges is that there's a difference between petty theft, or someone who steals a few items here and there, and then actual criminal rings who work together to hit several businesses to then turn around and sell the stolen goods. AB 2943 allows for crimes in concert to be charged as a felony rather than a misdemeanor by aggregating together all stolen property in the criminal's possession from the past 2 years. So if the same person has stolen under $950 worth of goods every day, all of that can be aggregated together to charge them with a felony rather than being limited to a misdemeanor. Senate Bill 905 is another bill passed in a packet of new laws addressing crime. This bill aimed to address a gap in existing law by adding a provision to the penal code that makes unlawful entry of a vehicle a crime that can be punished by up to 3 years in state prison, as well as criminalize theft of property in conjunction with vehicle burglary, with the same ability to aggregate all stolen property from the past 2 years. This bill is so important because there's been a sharp increase in vehicle burglaries and theft of vehicle parts in California. A study conducted by MarketWatch revealed that California had the most car thefts of any state in the nation in 2023. And not only was it the state with the most thefts, but it doubled the thefts of its runner-up state, Texas. Can you believe that? It's one thing to come in first place. It's another thing to completely lap the competition. Unfortunately, this is a terrible competition to come in first place for. Also, as a side note, guess which area in California contributed the most to these thefts? You might be thinking the Bay Area. Oakland is a pretty dangerous place after all. Or I might guess the Sacramento-Stockton area, since I grew up there and it can be known for its crime. If you guessed either of those areas, you would be wrong. It was sunny Los Angeles. Why does my area have to be the problem area? Anyway, while those statistics address car thefts themselves, which was already a crime, they just show the increasing appetite that criminals have had over the past few years regarding breaking into cars, whether to steal the car itself or to steal car parts. I'm sure that you know someone who has had their catalytic converter stolen in the past few years. I know multiple people who have had that misfortune. In fact, just to pile on LA for a second, we became known as a hotspot for catalytic converter theft in 2022, as there was a surge to 19,000 of these thefts in just 1 year, which was more than triple the amount it was in 2021. It's safe to say that a crime like breaking into a vehicle and stealing from it does need stricter laws surrounding it to deter this behavior, and it is a good thing that SB 905 passed. These two bills specifically addressed rising crime related to theft. The actual intention behind passing these bills was actually to try to prevent support for Prop 36 by proving to those who wanted the proposition to pass that the legislature and the governor were taking crime seriously without the need to roll back Prop 47. Obviously, I disagree with those motives, but I still think we can be thankful that even before Prop 36 passed, the legislature did pass bills like these to strengthen areas of the law that were being overlooked. And of course, we can be thankful that with the passage of Prop 36, the themes in these bills are only advanced further. I'm excited to see the effect that these bills in conjunction with Prop 36 will have on theft around us. While we've talked a lot about theft, it isn't the only type of crime being addressed through new legislation. I want to pivot to another very important topic, human trafficking. There were multiple bills passed to strengthen penalties against various forms of human trafficking this year. According to the National Human Trafficking Hotline, California has the highest number of reported human trafficking victims. Once again, our beloved Los Angeles, as well as San Diego, are two of the top cities in the entire nation for human trafficking. I feel like I'm talking myself out of being thankful for living here. There are a few reasons for it being so prominent in our state, one of which is being population size. We have the most populous state in the country, so we have more people who are at risk of being trafficked. Los Angeles makes sense because of the entertainment industry with Hollywood, and San Diego makes sense because we're so close to the border. Regardless, there's good news. SB 1414 was a bipartisan measure to reclassify sex trafficking of a minor under the age of 16 from a misdemeanor to a felony. Now, I'm not sure why that was ever a misdemeanor in the first place. That 100% should have always been a felony. But either way, I'm glad that it is now. This builds off of a bill that was passed last year, SB 14. SB 14 went after the people who are selling minors into sex trafficking, making that a serious felony and a strike under California's three strikes laws. Now, SB 1414 specifically targets the buyers who are purchasing children through sex trafficking. The bill isn't perfect, as the author had to make concessions to get it passed with bipartisan support. Originally, it applied to all minors under 18, but after discussion and revisions, they dropped it to ages 15 and under. The author, Republican Senator Shannon Grove, expressed that she was disappointed by the exclusion of 16 and 17-year-olds. For them, the offense could be a felony or a misdemeanor, depending on how the prosecutor wants to classify it. The opposition, who argued for removing these ages from the bill, argued that it won't address the root causes of human trafficking, but it will just increase the prison population. Yet, I still think anyone who's committing this crime needs to be prosecuted for it and put in prison, even while the state works on further efforts to stop human trafficking at the source. It is so sad that sex trafficking, especially trafficking of minors, is so pervasive in our state. So I am incredibly thankful for the efforts of Senator Grove to keep pursuing legislation around this issue. And I'm excited to hear that she will continue fighting to expand the laws to include all minors. I'm hoping that building up good legislation like these bills will have a real effect on saving the lives of children who are enduring the most horrific experience a person could ever put them through. There's one more topic I want to discuss in the realm of crime and enforcement, the drug epidemic. The amount of drug trafficking and overdose deaths that we have seen in just the past 2 or 3 years is harrowing. Drug addiction is so powerful and completely destructive to the lives of those who get involved in it. It's also a unique challenge because while I firmly believe in personal responsibility and the power of the choices that you make, once someone is addicted to a drug like OxyContin or fentanyl, these substances literally change their neurology to make them dependent on the drugs. In a way, because of how these drugs change the chemistry of your brain, after enough use, they take away an individual's choice whether to use or not. According to a study on the neurobiology of opioid dependence, drugs like heroin, oxy, or fentanyl bind to receptors in the brain. There are two types, called reward pathways and pain pathways. The drug provides pain relief when it's bound to the pain pathway, but when it binds to the reward pathway, then it releases dopamine, which brings intense pleasure, giving that high effect. The brain then seeks out any way to continue producing that good feeling, but once an individual uses the drug again, it won't provide the same intensity as the first time. This means it requires more of the drug or a more intense version of the drug in the future. This is why certain drugs are gateway drugs, as they clear the path for more intense drugs down the line once the brain needs more and more of that high feeling. Because the brain is now used to that high, when an addict stops using drugs, they go through withdrawals. But these aren't just a few aches or pains or a craving like you and I might crave something sweet at the end of the day. Most addicts feel like they will literally die because the pain is so intense. They also often struggle with severe anxiety or depression as their brain has been changed to need a higher level of dopamine to experience pleasure. It is such a sad circumstance, and it completely changes your life and your body forever. This is why we see so many campaigns against drugs by parents, as just one or two bad decisions of a rebellious teenager can alter or end their child's life forever. The drug epidemic is a serious problem, and drug trafficking in our state has life-threatening ramifications. You're probably thinking, isn't this episode supposed to be upbeat and full of Thanksgiving? Why are we talking about the drug epidemic? Let's get to the good news. Senate Bill 19 established the Fentanyl Misuse and Overdose Prevention Task Force with the goal of investigating the use and abuse of fentanyl across the state, assessing the source and solicitation of the drug, consulting with organizations to strengthen the state's efforts to prevent misuse, and analyzing if existing statutes against misuse are adequate. I know that personally, when I hear of a task force being created, it isn't always the most comforting idea. Are they really going to address the core issues? But I think there are a few aspects to be encouraged about here. First, like we just discussed, the drug epidemic is a huge crisis and it deserves special attention. I think it's a good start that our state is acknowledging that and developing a team to focus on it. Second, the bill has provisions for dates they must give a report and for when the work of the task force must conclude. They have to issue a report on July 1st of 2025, and their work will then have to end by December 1st of the same year. By giving end dates, it's a good indication that this work can't drag on forever with no results. In theory, there should be pressure as there's an actual timeline of when answers must be provided. Another bill that speaks to this issue that was passed this year is Assembly Bill 2429. This bill requires high schools to include education on the dangers of fentanyl use as part of the curriculum needed to graduate. I also believe this is a great way to directly address our youth on an issue that is facing them at schools, at parties, and for some of them, even at home. While I believe that parents and the family unit should be training up their children and teaching them wise principles, the sad reality is that a lot of kids don't have that parental guidance, or they have loved ones who are themselves suffering from drug addiction. Implementing drug awareness into school curriculum also isn't new. I remember when I was in elementary school, we had Red Ribbon Week, where they got all of our grades together and had rallies to educate us on the dangers of drug use. The fact that I still remember that shows it was impactful to me, and if we can even help just one high schooler learn the weight, significance, and danger of drugs that they might see others using around them, I think it's a great start. Lastly, Assembly Bill 2115 was also passed this year, and it seeks to expand access to methadone, a medication that's used to combat opioid addiction by blocking the damage that prolonged drug exposure has caused to the brain. Existing law makes California the state with some of the strictest laws on accessing methadone. Because methadone is itself an opioid, patients can't be prescribed as much as they need for weeks at a time. Their treatment has to be observed at clinics, which requires that patients come every day to receive a daily dose of the treatment. While this model in itself is not bad, it's meant to encourage consistency and responsibility of treatment. Unfortunately, drug dealers have taken advantage of patients who are waiting in long lines outside of treatment clinics, and drug addicts have repeatedly been preyed upon and relapsed as a result. This bill would shift the treatment model to allow easier access to care, as well as reduce the burden on patients to be seen by clinics. It specifically does this by allowing physicians to give patients 72 hours worth of methadone treatment, allowing expedited entry into treatment programs by removing certain stringent requirements, like the fact that the patient must have a year of opioid abuse before receiving treatment, and allowing physicians discretion in dosage. These are meant to be steps forward in helping desperate people get out from under addiction to such deadly drugs. And while I recognize that it's a delicate balance between setting wise guardrails and widening access, with the fentanyl crisis ever increasing the way that we see it has been in recent years, I believe taking steps to address it is a positive decision. All right, we've talked about theft crime, human trafficking, and the drug epidemic. I hope so far you are encouraged to see that there's been good legislation passed in all these serious areas to continue moving the ball forward on helping resolve these issues in our state. To wrap up our discussion of good legislation, I want to end with one more bill related to education that I thought was a great proposal and I hope will have a positive impact on our future generations. Assembly Bill 1871 was passed in September, and it requires coursework for grades 7 to 12 to include instruction on personal financial literacy. According to the LA Times, this will include balancing a checkbook, managing credit cards, and avoiding scams. This comes off the heels of the Center for Financial Literacy at Champlain College giving California an F in the subject, as no courses currently require coverage of this topic. Requiring this type of course is not a new phenomenon, as the passage of AB 1871 makes California the 26th state to require a course on financial literacy. The California State Superintendent of Public Instruction celebrated the bill, describing it as such, quote, "Our young people need and deserve a clear understanding of personal finance so that they can make educated financial choices and build stable, successful futures for themselves and their future families. By adding personal finance to our high school graduation requirements, we acknowledge that managing household finances and building financial stability are essential life skills. Every child should have the opportunity to build these essential skills before navigating adult financial choices, not just those who happen to have the opportunity to learn these concepts at home or through an elective." Personally, I love this initiative. In the same way that I believe we should encourage more trade schools and courses on practical skills, I think teaching young people about how to manage their finances is an absolutely necessary life skill that can be used whether or not they go to college. It sets them up for understanding the world in a way that our young people today are not actively thinking about. I would have loved a course like this in high school, and I'm thankful that it will be implemented in our schools moving forward. Good legislation isn't the only thing that we can be thankful for this year. As someone who's conservative, I'm also grateful for the movement that we've seen across our state from a far-left position to a more moderate position on some key issues. We saw this firsthand with the results of the ballot initiatives. The week after the election, we examined the results together and saw that initiatives for minimum wage and rent control both failed. This is huge for our economy. While rent control has had a rocky time getting passed in prior elections, minimum wage certainly has not. Since 1996, there have been 28 ballot propositions to increase the minimum wage. Only two of these measures have ever been rejected, with voters passing 26 minimum wage raising initiatives. The rejection of this election's Prop 32 is just the third minimum wage initiative to ever fail. Antonio Villaraigosa, former mayor of Los Angeles, looked at the moderate swing in some of the results and commented, quote, "Are we really listening to our people, or are we spending all of our time telling them what they ought to do?" Assembly Republican leader James Gallagher also responded by saying, quote, "It's a new day in California. The shift is beginning." He may not be wrong, especially when you take into consideration the shift seen in California in terms of the presidential race. Did California still go to Democratic nominee Kamala Harris? Yes. But did you know that nearly every county in California shifted Republican this election? I'm looking at a map put out by the San Francisco Chronicle showing shift by county, and it has red arrows for a shift to the right and blue arrows for a shift to the left. I see one blue arrow on the map. The state overall shifted 4 points to the Republican Party. That is wild. This matters a lot. For everyone I'm hearing complain about the fact that California's electoral votes didn't switch parties, I just want us to stop for a second and remember that change is slow, but change is moving in a more moderate, even conservative direction. Take Fresno County as a prime example. Fresno County has not swung Republican since 2004. In 2020, Joe Biden won Fresno County by 8 points. In 2024, Trump won the county by 6 points. Do you realize what a massive swing that is? That means he was up from 2020 by 14 points, and that he won a county that hadn't voted in the majority for his party in 20 years. Do I believe that California is suddenly conservative? Absolutely not. We have a long way to go. After all, there is still a supermajority in the legislature for the Democratic Party, and voters passed 2 massive bond initiatives, as well as a constitutional amendment destroying the definition of marriage. But I think that we can still be thankful for the shift that we saw, and I think we should feel more encouraged and motivated to build on that shift for the 2026 midterm. It shows, if nothing else, that hope is never lost so long as you don't give up. On a more superficial and hopefully fun note, I want to list out a few things that I love about our state, even with its flaws. These characteristics aren't nearly as important as the legislation that we cover each week on the show, and they aren't meant to trivialize the real challenges that California residents, myself included, face every day in our state. But I like to remind myself, and now you as well, of some of the unique things about our state that do make me happy to live here. First, weather. We have incredible weather. The day I'm recording this episode, the high was 75 degrees and sunny. There aren't many places that are seeing perfect weather into late November. We're looking at some upcoming rain, so maybe by the time this episode is released, it won't be sunny. But the fact that I have been able to enjoy beautiful fall weather up until now is a gift that I love to enjoy here. Second, food. We have incredible food. California is known first and foremost for its agriculture, as our state is the powerhouse of the country when it comes to produce. But even more than agriculture, we also have an incredible international influence on our cuisine all across the state. After all, what other state has street tacos, Little Italy, Fisherman's Wharf, In-N-Out, Korean barbecue, Xiaolongbao, and killer avocado toast? Third, diversity. California is considered the most diverse state in the nation. No one racial or ethnic group dominates the majority, and we're home to immigrant communities from over 60 countries. Our voter guide is translated into 40 different languages. I think that is what makes our state so unique and brings different cultures to our communities. That's also a contributing factor as to why there is such a range of cuisines, as we just discussed. It's a true melting pot of people from all around the world, and it embodies the hope and ambitions that America offers to those in other countries. It's unfortunate that diversity has been used as a weapon by some. Do I agree with illegal immigration? No. Do I believe that you should value and cherish American culture when you come to live here? Absolutely. Do I think that there should be discrimination in policies to favor racial minorities for the sake of diversity in and of itself? No. But is it inherently a negative thing when people live in the same place who come from all different upbringings and backgrounds? No, it's a beautiful thing. After all, my own husband is a first-generation immigrant, and he is one of the most patriotic, America-loving people I know. Immigrants who value our country and bring aspects of their cultures along with them make our country more rich, more interesting, and beautiful, and I can appreciate that about California. Fourth, beaches. California has incredible beaches. Living in Southern California makes me biased on that point, but I can't help pointing out the fact that on any given weekend, we can travel to Santa Barbara, Santa Monica, Malibu, Camarillo, or San Diego, and any of those places have incredible views, experiences, and beaches. Growing up, my family frequently vacationed in the Monterey Bay area, which also had beautiful beaches and a serene coastal vibe. There's just nothing like a sunset along the California coast. And speaking of beaches, lastly, landscapes. Our state is so diverse in the types of landscapes and communities that we see from northern to southern California. We've got forests, mountains, places that snow in the winter, lakes and rivers, beaches, places that are always 75 degrees and sunny, valleys. Pretty much any landscape you can think of, we have here. It makes it such a fun place to explore constantly, and there's always someplace new to visit. Lastly, I can't end a Thanksgiving episode without talking about what I am most thankful for this year, and that is the Lord's work in and through the church, as well as the priceless gift of salvation that we have freely in Christ's finished work on the cross. If you are a Christian, you know that this is the anchor for our anxious souls and the hope that we have each and every year, regardless of what is happening in our country politically. That the God of the universe would love us enough to come to earth, live a perfect life, bear the wrath that we deserve, and conquer death, then offer us his righteousness as a reality that will never fade, never get old, and never be overcome by the challenges that we face in our society, our country, and our world. I am most thankful that he would choose to save me despite my unworthiness, and that he promises he loves me and will never forsake me despite my unfaithfulness. If you do not know Christ, or you do not know the peace and joy of salvation, I would plead with you to consider your great need. You see the effects of sin in the world around you. You see the decay of society and the evil of crime. Consider that you too are a sinner who has offended a holy God who created the world around you. You are in great need of salvation, but salvation cannot be earned by fallen humanity. There's nothing that you could do to be good enough in the eyes of a perfect God. Salvation is only found in the sacrifice of Christ, who was a real person, although still fully God, who lived a perfect life and died to cover our sin. The only way his righteousness can cover you is if you recognize your need today and surrender your life to him. I would encourage you to talk to someone who does know Christ, or to start by reading the Gospel of Mark. In Christ, you will find that wherever you live, whatever the circumstances, you can always be thankful for the unending grace, peace, and purpose there is in knowing the one true God. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. I hope it was encouraging to you as you prepare to celebrate Thanksgiving this week. If you're enjoying this podcast, please subscribe today and pass it along to your friends, family, and fellow Californians. You can follow me on social media at It's Tess Abraham, and you can find out more about the podcast at thecaliforniaconversation.com. Have a very happy Thanksgiving, and I'll see you back here next week for another episode of The California Conversation.